Thank you all for showing up. This is the second year for the War College here at Celesticon. My name is Dana Lombardi. I am very fortunate to know some incredible people like Leland, who are historians. They actually do this professionally, and that's one of the things that he does within the modern world. But he's going to look back at World War II and some of the lessons and some of the myths about 1940. And I would like to just urge you to hold your questions till the end, if that's the point where you prefer that, because we have enough time.
Okay.
And then what we can do is have a back-and-forth discussion at the end of the program. Andy, you want to hit the little... Can you just lower the lights?
Yes, okay. I can do all those.
What do you think?
You can have that.
You like...
That's good.
Is that
all
good?
Right.
That's
great. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Leland Erickson and his talk on the myths of 1940.
Thank you for that introduction, Dana, and thank you all for coming.
Today I'm here to speak about, if you'll indulge me, some persisting myths about the French army and France's initial resistance to the Nazi invasion in May to June 1940. Many of you may be aware that they lasted 6 weeks. They were expected to do a lot better than that. Courage, or rather a lack thereof, is something the French have been blamed of in popular imagination for their loss in such a short period of time. Well, I would argue that that is in fact not what entirely right or accurate. To begin with, one of the persisting myths that I personally identified. Number one is France was Germany's strategic equal. Therefore, myth number two, France should have been more than able to match Germany in a stand-up fight. Myth three, if France had just done her part, the Allies should have won. In other words, somehow, for whatever reasons that are uniquely French, the French just didn't commit themselves all in as they should have done, and for that reason they failed. And for that reason they took Holland and Belgium along down with them. Myth number four, the French are basically cowardly, and therefore, myth number five, the French campaign was basically a cakewalk for Germany. And you hear all the stupid jokes about why do the French plant all those nice trees along the road so the Germans can march in the shade, etc. Exactly. Well, you know, I've been interested in this topic I've studied war since I was about eight. It's a weird kid. But I've been interested in this whole topic of the French campaign since high school, really. And I always thought, wow, in the First World War, they fought so ferociously. Why suddenly are they just like, we don't care. 6 weeks, we're done. We're all surrendering. Well, if one looks at the newsreel footage and so on, you get that impression. Well, here's a map of France and Germany and Belgium. And kind of, it's a little fuzzy, but essentially, you've got this nice... long frontier with Germany, and with neutral countries, none of which themselves are really in a position to stop a concerted German invasion. Historically, this had always been kind of a thoroughfare for invasions back and forth. French country is, especially through the heart of the country and right to Paris, you see the nice red square there, it's kind of an open run. So really, when you get down to it, there's not a lot. There are areas that would favor defense, but most do not, especially the open country. It's great stuff if you want to maneuver around. So to begin, France's history is a long one. It's a rich one, and its impact on the current political landscape of France cannot be underestimated. Longings for past glories drive the right wing of France's body politic as surely as the Republican and later socialist utopian passions of liberté, égalité, fraternité drive the political left. Now, France's history since the rise and fall of the glorious conquest of Napoleon Bonaparte has been written indelibly and in large part in the blood of the French people in an exponentially increasing fashion during the first half of the 20th century, and it still shapes their politics today. I mean, heck, even the Dreyfus Affair can cause an argument if you're taking a taxi cab in Paris. L'affaire. There's been a repeated string of military defeats. They play a large role in her history in the 19th and 20th centuries, and they have long-reaching consequences, considering her victory in 1918 was at such a dreadful cost. They all affected France's economic strength in profound and varying degrees. The shrinking economic fortunes have only added to France's challenges to balance the competing desires of a body politic with economic reality. Reality bites. These military conflicts have also driven at times profound social change in France, including ushering in at last the extension of the vote to women for the first time in 1945. So women didn't even vote till 1945. Their colonial ambitions have also played a profound role in their fortunes, for good or ill, to the present day. I mean, some of the stuff we're dealing with in the world now. Algeria, the Arab Spring, really. Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, French colonies, or former French colonies, Senegal, and so on. What I'm trying to present today is, again, as I said, these myths, and I hope to shoot some gaping holes in them. And at the very least, perhaps generate more interest in all of you who have been so kind to share your time with me today and listen to my mad conclusions about this still controversial chapter of 20th century history. So, let's start with myth one about France being somehow a strategic equal to Germany. We should have been able to match Germany. Well, I would assert this is one of the subtlest and most persistent myths. It's not spoken. People don't talk about it. They just sort of go, oh, the French, they collapsed because they didn't have guts, or they had lousy leadership, or it was their doctrine, which is not untrue. But nobody seems to stop and say, well, wait a minute. Those conclusions require you assume that they could match them. Well, they can't. And the numbers don't tell you pretty much straight up what the story is. First of all, this is part of French political history. Okay, this is a French way of solving political dissent traditionally.
And IKEA.
That's exactly why I took that picture, because I thought I needed a picture of a guillotine to kind of give people a background. I mean, the French history. To me, I consider this a marvelous example of French political pragmatism. I got to hit you with a short history of the French republics, because by the time we get to 1940, we're dealing with the Fourth Republic. That would be the Third Republic. The First Republic was about 1792. This is how it got established. After that, Napoleon Bonaparte comes to power. He says, Republic? No. Empereur. You know, so everybody, I'm France, France is me. So I get rid of Napoleon. Back comes the Bourbon dynasty. Well, revolution of 1848, no more Bourbon dynasty. The heirs overthrown, now we have the Second Republic. Well, along comes Napoleon's nephew, Louis Napoleon III, and he says, Republic, non, Empereur. Vive la France, vive la Louis. So now we have the Second Empire. Well, Second Empire picks a fight with the Prussians, and the Prussians bring all their German pals in. We have the Franco-Prussian War, which in about a year's time puts an end to the Second Empire and creates the Third Republic. They captured the Emperor at Sedan along with his army. The Emperor is no more. He's forced to abdicate. The French declare a republic. They keep trying to fight. Paris gets destroyed. They have to give it up. And in doing so, they give up the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine. And this creates this intense monomania in French politics to get Alsace-Lorraine back from the hated Germans. And that becomes their focus in the Great War. It breaks out in 1914. So you have, again, this succession of glory and defeat. Napoleon and defeat, and empire and defeat, and so on. And it just keeps going and going. And it really isn't unique to the French. I mean, the other European powers were all grabbing for empire. They're all trying to do their thing, and England's always the dominant rival. So what happens is, oh, yes. Let me share this picture. There we go. Prussian tour group in Paris in 1871. This was a victory parade of the Prussian army after the French finally surrendered to the siege of Paris. Most of the city at this point was in complete ruins. They pretty much burned it to the ground because the French had decided to fight them in the streets. So there's a lot of bitterness, a lot of animosity, and this rivalry between Germany and France. So this is not forgotten. So we get to 1914. And the first thing the French are trying to do, their whole strategy is focused on recovering Alsace and Lorraine. Well, needless to say, this was the salt in the wounds for the French, was this destruction of Paris and the loss of Alsace-Lorraine. And this really affected their domestic politics. And so this is, of course, the period between this and the First World War. That's when we had the Dreyfus Affair, in which a very loyal French officer who happened to be Jewish was framed for treason. And he wound up being sent to Devil's Island for his trouble. And that really divided the country. In fact, to this day, there's a terrific amount of friction over the Dreyfus Affair in the 1870s. I mean, it's like our civil war in some parts of the country on steroids in the minds of many Frenchmen. So the French were focused on recovering what they lost. There's Alsace-Lorraine, big piece of their territory. That means that the Germans are, in a sense, closer to Paris the next time for round two. So they really want to get it back. So that's kind of what that's about. So they're planning and plotting and scheming. They're building alliances. We have the alliances, the Triple Entente, and the Entente Cordiale between England and France. So the old enemies may patch things up because they don't like the way the Germans are getting bigger and badder. The Germans are engaged in their naval arms race with the British. The British, of course, find this troubling. And so they're trying to outbuild them in battleships. And we have this lovely tangle of alliances that goes up in smoke as soon as the Archduke Ferdinand is assassinated and France is drawn straight in, because they are allied with England and they're allied with Russia, and they promising that, oh no, we're going to get you this time. So they go straight at Alsace-Lorraine, and something another lecture. They had, of course, developed a secret weapon for this. This is how focused they were. This gun was supposed to solve the problem and make the French be a miracle weapon. It's a 75-millimeter field gun, and it, for its day, it has something revolutionary, a breech mechanism and a recoil system that lets you fire at an insanely high rate for an artillery gun. Boom, boom, boom. I mean, I think the record is something like almost 30 rounds a minute with a trained crew. I mean, it was just astonishing, the rate of fire. So the French thought, oh, we have a wonder weapon. Therefore, we do not need to make heavy artillery, really. We don't have to worry about that because it's going to go quick. It'll be everybody will rush forward with the bayonet and the flags flying, the bugles sounding, and we're going to sweep them from the field with our 75s. Well, it didn't work. So instead, it settled out into trench warfare. And this is where it gets really ugly. Because the first thing that happens is that the Great War, 1914-18, is going to leave a permanent scar on the French psyche. The events still echo today. If you go to France, you can go to some of the cemeteries where the Allied war dead are buried. And it just silences you. It's just fields of crosses or headstones. There are still areas in France today from the Great War that are completely unsafe and are barred from the public to go in. Areas around Verdun and so on. They're still finding unexploded ordnance. A friend of mine told me when he did his work in Belgium, he said on the news they were interviewing a NATO bomb disposal expert who had just removed a shell from a farmer's field in Belgium. And he said the worst are the gas shells. He said, because they're so old and the shells, the casing is now rusting away and it's being paper thin, and they're still full of chemical agents, phosgene, mustard gas, and so on. So he says, you try to move one of those, it breaks like brittle paper or rotten wood. It'll just break. Boof. You now have a chemical release. And he says they're the worst. Well, we're still finding them. Basically, the sheer scope of the slaughter on the Western Front from 1914 to 18, it's just incomprehensible for those of us living today in the 21st century. The protracted fight for the French city of Verdun in 1960 produced 460,000 casualties in 5 months. That's 460,000 French casualties in 5 months. Every unit of the French army rotated through Verdun and did at least one combat tour in Verdun. This includes the colonial forces in Western Europe. Now, we can't even conceive of that. I mean, I don't remember my Civil War too well, but I don't even think we lost that many in the Civil War in total. Pardon me?
600,000.
Yeah, 600, that's right. And most of that was disease, if I remember right.
No?
Both disease and, yeah. But in this case, 460,000 casualties, battle casualties. That's just Verdun. The Germans were trying to capture Verdun. They sustained 300,000 casualties for their efforts. They were finally driven back. The French rallying cry being, "Ils ne passeront pas," they shall not pass. It was followed up by a very ill-advised and incompetently planned Nivelle offensive named after General Robert Nivelle, who was one of, I think, one of history's more notorious imbeciles in uniform. He decided to attack along the Chemin des Dames ridge and throw his troops straight at it. He thought, he was an artillery officer, thought more artillery is better. Artillery good, more artillery better. I put so much artillery on the problem, the Germans will be swept away, the troops will advance, we shall capture territory, we will win the war. In fact, what the Germans had done is that they had pulled back their troops from the front line trenches and just left outposts forward because they knew the first barrage would land in the front line trenches, so they kept the troops back. And they kept their observation posts up front, so when stuff started coming down, the observers would call it in, they'd take shelter in a nice deep dugout, and then they'd wait, because they knew when the barrage lifted, the French soldiers would be halfway across no man's land in a machine gun range. It was a debacle. They captured about 300 yards total, and they sustained 300,000 casualties for the effort. 300 yards, 300,000 casualties. So now we're up to 760,000 casualties.
That's 100,000.
It's unbelievable. And again, we Americans can't conceive of this. This is like alien to us, this sort of thing. And France's population is smaller than that of Germany. This is back to one of my myths about they're their equal. They're not their equal. They're a smaller population, about half the population.
Total U.S. casualties in World War II are
million
something? No, it's 700,000. Yeah, it was nothing like this. This is, and again,
Den casualties aren't the same, but in World War I, the French suffered about 200 for every dead soldier. And, the United States suffered about 3.5 in World War II.
This is part of the thing too, is the nature of the front lines, the nature of that. Basically, that the Nivelle offensive was the last straw for the French soldiers, and this triggered what are called mutinies of 1917. But essentially, they're not really mutinies, quite what we would think about them as mutinies. They're more like a work stoppage. They go on strike. They don't necessarily just throw down their guns and run away. Rather, they withdraw, or they stay in their trenches and refuse to go over the top. And they demand reforms. They basically say, look, it's not that we're refusing to fight, it's that we're refusing to just keep doing the same stupid thing over and over again, expecting a different result each time. We want some reforms, we want a little better pay, we want leave to be really leave, where we're rested, not just put on labor detail. We want some leadership that knows what they're doing and doesn't just keep throwing us into the teeth of the grinder. Well, Nivelle is sacked, thank God, and they bring in Philippe Pétain and appoint him commander of the French army. And just to give you an idea of Verdun and what it looks like, this is an aerial view of Fort Douaumont, which was one of the focal points of the battle. The reason it's all chewed up, it's all artillery, nonstop. Day after day after day. It's a lunar landscape. Whatever greenery, whatever trees were there, there were woods around the area, they are gone. It's just, again, inconceivable. Like a siege that just, like a Groundhog Day meets a siege. You know, it just doesn't end and it keeps repeating day after day. This is, again, this is shaping the French worldview about war and the run-up to the Second World War. Basically, the army's exhausted at this point. And they are in a bad way. They're not completely broken or beaten yet, and they're not without fighting spirit, but they are in a bad way, and they know it. They're stretched thin. Well, 1917 brings America into the war. It also brought something else into the war, French tanks. So Pétain decides that in addition to reforms, he is also going to wait for the tanks and the Americans, because he knows they're going to be the game changer. 1 million fresh American soldiers, a modern weapon that can actually overcome the machine gun and barbed wire. So he's going to wait. And he does. And that results in a win. And essentially, with the French army, with their tanks, and now with the Americans coming on the line, the Germans launch a desperate counterattack. They almost make it to Paris, but they run out of steam. And it's mainly their fault, though the Allies help them along because they do keep fighting. But the problem was it was an offensive without a sense of direction. Hindenburg and Ludendorff just kept telling him, keep going, keep going. Just keep attacking. Well, which direction? No, just keep going. You broke through, keep going. Well, that's allowed the Allies to kind of canalize them away from Paris in any kind of coherent objective, and they just petered out. And at that point, the Americans are being thrown in line, and at that point, the Germans are thrown back on the defensive, and finally they collapse. Well, the resurgent French army and their American allies, they broke the German lines in a series of ferocious battles that followed, and they began to drive the whole German front into retreat. And that retreat continued until an armistice was agreed on, and a ceasefire was arranged. Now, the armistice brought with it the Treaty of Versailles, which was loaded with draconian terms. And this really set the stage for a war-weary of victorious France to face a worse fate a mere 22 years later. Germany wanted revenge. But that hasn't come yet. So the enthusiastic call to arms in 1914 in France and the eagerness to avenge the humiliation of 1870-71 led to this meat grinder. French recklessness and lack of appreciation for the impact of the dramatic shift forward in weapons technology carried with it a frightful butcher's bill. We're talking 11% of the entire French population, overwhelmingly all male, were either killed or wounded during the Great War. This slaughter was of over 1 million French killed, over 4 million wounded, totaling over 73% casualties out of the entire number of 8.4 million men mobilized by France for the Great War. It's left an indelible mark on their psyche as a people. And to this day, essentially, this is how the French see war. Absolute futility. This man, I couldn't tell for sure. I was researching it. I don't know if he's just exhausted or dead, but this is how they see it. And this is what they don't forget. And there is, as I said, in Verdun, you can't even go there. It's just not safe. The ground is still, you can see how the ground was changed artificially by the constant shelling. So this is what war looks like to France after this effort. And the thing to keep in mind is they started the First World War with a smaller population than Germany and a much smaller industrial base than Germany and a much smaller economy. And they managed to hold on by throwing everyone in. Gentlemen, they'd have taken all of us.
89% of the eligible males were in the French army.
Yeah. Yeah, the Germans never had to go quite that far. They take every one of us. They take me with my stick and all and throw me in the line.
The industrial effort in World War I was incredible.
Yeah.
They outfitted almost the entire United States Army.
Yeah, they did. They came from 75mm guns, a tiny handful of anything larger, nothing to engage in the kind of protracted siege warfare is what this really was. They had to start from zero. Aircraft from a few novelty flivvers to modern combat aircraft, some of the best in the world at the time. They had the largest air force in the world at the time. They had one of the most technically minded armies in the world at the time. French soldiers got to the front not so much by walking or marching as they did in 1914, but by 1918 they were being brought to the front in truck convoys. They kept Verdun going by constantly using trucks to move supplies to the frontline units. They had tanks. They had the grandfather of the modern battle tank. They created it, the Renault 7 FT-17, first tank with a revolving turret. So our gentlemen, our doughboys, George S. Patton Jr., he learned his trade as a tank commander on an FT-17 in the Argonne. But this is war to the French, and they never forgot it. So when the news of the armistice broke, not every Frenchman appreciated it, actually. This is the thing to remember. And again, this is about what I call a little bit about French courage. One of their toughest and hard-driving frontline commanders, General Charles Mangin, when he heard about the armistice, he broke into tears and he shouted the following to his staff. No, no, no. We must go right into the heart of Germany. The armistice should be signed there. The Germans will not admit they are beaten. You do not end wars like this. Who will see that the conditions are enforced? The Allies? A coalition has never survived the danger that it has created. It is a fatal error, and France will pay for it. He said that in 1918.
And he was right.
He was dead right. They called Mangin the Butcher. That is, his troops called him the Butcher because he was so ruthless with their lives. However, he was not without his own heavy dose of guts. He was known to literally take a rifle and go on the line with his men. So he was seen many times stalking around within weapons shot with a rifle in his hand, with his staff kind of cowering behind him, following him. So he was quite a tough-as-nails character. He was a colonial commander originally. Did a lot of work in leading the French colonial forces. So he was also noted for his respect for and willingness to use African soldiers, but he used them and Frenchmen just equally hard. So they called him the Butcher for that reason. He died in 1925, and his warning was basically falling on deaf ears, because at this point you have a country that is psychologically and financially drained. Again, you can't discount the numbers. The manpower loss of the Great War was astonishing. It's tragic. And then, of course, you get the blowback of the Great Depression. And France took it really hard because for a number of years, the French staved off the Great Depression with artificial economic measures, which unfortunately meant that for them, the Great Depression hits in 1931, and it hits with a vengeance. And so immediately it causes all kinds of political blowback. And this, of course, in turn, the French are also dealing with the psychological blowback of this war, and one of their conclusions is, we're going to build fortifications. Forts worked at Verdun. We held on at Verdun because of Douaumont and the other forts, and we'd strip them of their guns. So forts must work. So forts that are stripped of their guns can work really well to stop an invading German army, and we know the Germans will come back someday. It's just their nature. Then a really elaborate fortification system loaded to the teeth with guns. They're never going to get into France proper again. So we've recaptured Alsace-Lorraine. We got our turf back. But we paid for it in our dearest blood. And this is going to carry another consequence, which I'll get to in a minute. So this is the rise of what we call the Maginot mentality. The idea of building forts. And this is because of the dreadful losses of the Great War, which the French refer to as the empty classes of 1919. You literally had classes of school classes where there were no young men. None of them came back, or they were empty. Like, where are my students? They didn't come back. So this creates in the French people, and of course, it transmits into their politics, a very deep anti-war sentiment. They just see it as futility. They see the futility of this man's demise. So the Minister of War, André Maginot, who was himself a soldier and who had been at Verdun, he decides we're going to build the most modern and impregnable fortification system in the world, and we don't have to have that aggressive 1914 attitude of fixed bayonets in charge. We're going to just defend ourselves. We're not aggressors. We're not going to do the wrong thing. We're going to do the right thing, but we're not going to just sit there. So they start pouring their money into the Maginot Line, building a whole series of fortifications. One misconception is that somehow this is a continuous belt of defenses. It's not. It's a series, a string of forts of different sizes and quality. Everything from the Gros Ouvrages, which are huge, elaborate, and really the ideal Maginot fortification. And then as the budget reality starts biting, as the Great Depression starts biting, the quality of the individual, the next fortifications that start coming online, it starts going downhill. And finally you get basically glorified a concrete bunker with firing ports and no weapons. So this was kind of their hope for their future security, the Maginot Line. They thought, we build enough of these, we put them all up and down the frontier, we will be safe. The Germans won't even think of attacking us. It would be folly. And we will, in essence, also send them an unspoken message. This will remind them of Verdun. This will remind them of the folly of attacking us, of the folly of fighting at all. That it's better to just talk. As Churchill said, it's better to jaw-jaw than to war-war. Well, the German reaction says this belt of fortifications stopped at the Belgian frontier, because we don't want to offend Belgium. There are they were our allies. They're neutral now. And they're just a little guy. So we don't want to scare them. If we build the fortifications all the way to the sea, like some are advocating, Belgium thinks we're going to just leave them out there flapping in the breeze for the Germans to take them. We can't do that. Well, unfortunately, pouring all this money into this means other things are neglected. The Great Depression hits. And, of course, we have Adolf Hitler comes to power in 1933 in Germany. Meanwhile, back in France, political fallout. This is French domestic politics in 1934 as Hitler is chancellor and he's doing his thing. They have no government. The government has yet again fallen. Basically, the whole mess of the fallout of the Great War losses, the economy, and so on, you've got a situation where one government after another falls apart in France. Let's see. You had their currency go into freefall and in danger of a complete collapse. The government the government at the time could not resolve the problem, and no less than 7 cabinet ministers, the right, led by President Poincaré, were able to win the confidence of the major bankers by implementing austerity measures, including spending cuts and raising taxes. So Poincaré's efforts worked, and the franc stabilized it at a quarter of its pre-war value. So the currency has lost three quarters of its value. Poincaré, of course, subsequently resigns for health reasons, and he's hailed as the Third Republic's greatest leaders. Well, yeah, he managed to stop the currency from imploding completely, and going down the way the German Weimar Republic's mark had done. But this is, again, it's happening after the Germans have pulling themselves together. So the French are behind that curve, in addition to all their other issues. So by 1931, as I said, here comes the Great Depression. Bam, bites them on the butt. Okay, it overwhelms their protective barriers, and basically France goes down economically. It's a huge downturn. It unseats the right-wing parties from office. It ushers in a coalition of radicals and socialists into the government. This didn't bring relief. They couldn't solve it. So because the left was divided against itself, and this was an acrimonious division because the radicals and the socialists were just constantly racked by scandal within their coalition. And so basically the French right wing starts to come back, and they have openly fascist elements that are sympathetic with Germany and say, we should be closer to the North, we should be pals with them. You know, Hitler's got it right, look what he's doing. So basically you get this riot. This was on February 6th in 1934. It ended with 15 dead and an estimated 1,500 injured. Premier Daladier is forced to resign, and yet another coalition government is formed. And this is the kind of division you have in French politics right up to the outbreak of war. This constant bickering, this constant acrimony, this constant division, right, left, center. Everybody's after everybody else. Everybody's got a gripe with everybody else. Nobody trusts anybody within the governments.
You left out and no one can make a decision.
Yeah, it's paralysis.
Sounds like us today.
Yeah, it's like what we have today on steroids.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't had a riot yet where 1,500 people are injured and 15 are killed. Thank God, and let's hope we never get there. But this is what we're talking about. Again, here comes this back to my myth I'm trying to shoot down here of, they should have been able to match them. They're their equal somehow. Well, they're not even stable. I mean, their politics is chaos.
Is this so, the point where some of their equipment was just not functional?
Well, by 31, they're starting to make noises about rearmament. By 35 is when, 34, 35 is when they're trying to start rearming because Germany's now getting their act together. Because here's German domestic politics around the same time. That's German domestic politics at the same time. I don't see much disagreement going on there.
No.
About the direction of the country. Of course, there's a lot of talk about Lebensraum and destiny and Volk and, you know, and the Treaty of Versailles and the stab in the back and so on. So you basically see France is struggling in the 30s between the jaws of their economy and the divided body politic. And this extreme polarization. So now Mussolini, of course, decides, you know what? I like Hitler. I don't like you Frenchies. And so this time around, if there's a, when the rematch comes, we're probably going to be with my friend Adolf here. So now they're starting to challenge the French in the Mediterranean. So the French are now like, uh-oh, maybe we need to build some new battleships here. So again, you have this massive expense, which they can ill afford, but they still do it anyway. So they start by launch, and then the Germans are building ships. So they're thinking, first we got to match the Germans, now we got the Italians at our back, and they're building new battleships, so we better build something new. So we have to pour all these millions of francs into building the Strasbourg and the Dunkirk, into building the Richelieu, the Jeanne d'Arc, and perhaps the Clemenceau. And she never got past her keel. This is a huge expense, and it also takes money away from rebuilding the Air Force, rebuilding the Army, which are going to be a lot more critical for France's security. France is really a land power more than a maritime power. So basically the French, of course, have this other unwillingness. Is we don't want to go to war again, but we may have to. So they're trying to, one of the things they're trying to fix is, well, we're not going to be strong enough on our own. We know this. We've lost too many men. Our birth rate took a nosedive because of those losses. On top of it was already in decline. And then now it just took this, it went into a steeper decline after the Great War because we just don't have enough men. And they're not getting married. And we don't support polygamy. So what are we going to do here? Well, we need allies. So we're going to try to build alliances. So we're going to look around for countries that we could ally ourselves with. The Russians aren't approachable. And we can't support the Bolsheviks anyway because that would get the right wing upset and going into one and wanting to have a civil war right now with the Bolsheviks in France. So what do? We're going to look around for others. So let's talk to the Yugoslavs. We helped form their country after World War I. So they try to form an alliance with Yugoslavia. They invite King Alexander to come and visit. They're going to build an alliance. And he's assassinated in the streets of Marseille. He and the French minister who was trying to pull this alliance together. And so, let's see if I can get his name here again. That's right, the Foreign Affairs Minister, Louis Barthol. The assassins were Croatian nationals. They were members of the Ustashi, which is the Croatian fascists. They were apparently financed by the Germans and they received some kind of aid, material aid, financial aid, and etc. from the Germans. Well, I do recall that during this period, the Germans were sending agents around to various countries, giving seed money, advice, and even weapons to fascist or pro-fascist movements to encourage trouble in the event of war with Great Britain and France, basically going to their colonies, going to South Africa, going to South America, because they looked at us and said, hey, Americans, you know, they could be troubled. So let's just make sure we plant the seeds for down the road just in case we need some help. Well, we can't have an alliance here. And so we talked to the Ustashi, the Croatian fascists, our fellow travelers, and they want an independent Croatia. We'll promise them an independent Croatia down the road if we can, and we'll help you. We'll help you get what you want. Take care of this guy. Well, they did. In fact, they got a twofer because they killed the foreign affairs minister at the same time. This was France's efforts at building alliances and how far it got them. So we come to the idea of myth number one. Well, let's go to the strategic picture here. The myth number one, France says Germany's equal. Let's just recap. Economic and industrial strength and industrial capacity are advantage Germany. We are talking a badly mauled economy, an industrial capacity that's about a third of Germany's. The French franc, remember, is now one quarter of its value. Population, again, advantage Germany. This is around 1938, these numbers. 80,600,000 Germany, 40,800,000 in France. And remember, France's population is disproportionately skewed by the loss of all those men in the First World War. So we have a much higher percentage of women. Great War losses, you know, advantage, in quotes, you know, question mark, France. They lost 1,397,800 killed, 4,266,000 wounded, one-third with permanent disability. Germany lost 2,050,897 killed, 4,247,143 wounded. Germany had a bigger population. Germany was able to absorb that loss. Her birth rate did not suffer the way France's did. Military strength in Germany in 1940. So May 10, 1940, the invasion of France and the Low Countries begins. Germany has 6,600,000 under arms, France has managed to pull 5 million together. Remember the demographic difference. Those Germans, they're overwhelmingly younger, fitter men. The Frenchmen, they are anybody that they can pull in. That from teenagers, such as the cadets at Salmour, to 40-somethings. Entire divisions whose rank and file are 40-plus. Those are the Category B reserve divisions. That particular chicken will come home to roost.
One bit of narrative complaint left out here was that the U.S. financed a rather large industrial growth in Germany in the 1920s, and France got nothing.
Yeah. Thank you for that correction there. Yeah, that's right. We put a lot of money into their growth. France was left standing. That's why France was so, another reason I think France was so punitive and vengeful with the Treaty of Versailles was for that very reason. They felt like we're going to be left out. And I remember, was it David Lloyd George was carrying on about how he wanted the Germans to pay for homes for heroes for the British veterans. So hence the damages in the war guilt clause, which really, to me, was just throwing fuel, gasoline on the fire of the German nationalism. So basically, this is myth number one. I don't think that when one looks at just these facts alone, you can even say France was their equal. Not even close. Well, France is trying to rearm. They need to rearm. Germany is dangerous. Germany is building herself up. She's rearming. What are we going to do? Well, we're not going to get a choice. So despite all of the differences, France starts to try to rearm. So Hitler's got the cooperation of his industry. His industrial people, he pretty much they got a sweetheart deal with one another. You know, they do things his way. They're fine with it because he lets them run things the way they want to run things. He abolishes the trade unions after he got them on board with his national socialism. And as soon as he's in power, he abolished trade unions and made them illegal, made organizing labor illegal. And he was doing away with all kinds of stuff that had hamstrung industry. So, okay, he's got them on board, he's kicked everybody in line, the weapons are starting to roll out of the assembly lines. The French try to respond. This is an example of French response. This is the Marine Saulnier 406. She can do about 300 miles an hour with the toolbox open. Maneuverable enough. Half the plane is still made like in World War I. It's an aluminum frame with fabric. Otherwise, it looks pretty modern. She can top out about 300 miles an hour, as I said. She has a cannon in the nose, 20-millimeter cannon. She has a couple of light machine guns in the wings. This is what France's aircraft industry could produce in time for 1940. This was the most numerous fighter airplane they had. They produced just over 1,000 in total. Meet his German equivalent, Messerschmitt 109E. This is the state-of-the-art fighter aircraft in 1940. She's over 50 miles an hour faster than the Marine. She has three 20-millimeter cannon, two in the wings and one in the nose, two machine guns. The plane is entirely encased in metal skinning. This is one of the top fighter aircraft at that point in the war anywhere in the world. German pilots came to regard the Marine as basically an easy kill. Adolf Galland, when he was in the Battle of France, one of his observations was he saw a French fighter, he went after it, and then he thought, oh, it's a good old Marine. Downed it immediately.
So how would you feel the 109 versus the Zero?
Again, tactics. We'll touch on that. You see, they're doing what Claire Chennault was advocating in China. You don't dogfight. You don't get into turns with an airplane that's going to outturn you. You have 50-mile-an-hour advantage in speed, and that's exactly what the Germans did. They could choose the time and the place that they attacked the Marine. The Marine could outturn them. That's about all it could do. And it didn't have the staying power, and it could not take a hit. And so they suffered accordingly. Now, of course, the French recognize that they're having problems. They recognize that they're running behind the curve. You know, again, the myth is they should be able to match Germany. Well, look at that. Like what I just said about the qualitative differences between. It's not just quantitative. The Germans are out building them. It's qualitative. That Marine was about the best thing they could squeeze out. And remember, while they're doing this, the communists are going on strike in the armaments plants because of the non-aggression pact between Germany and Stalin's Russia. So they're getting the word from Moscow through the party grapevine. You know, don't support the militarist capitalist You know, we have this, you know, you shouldn't be cooperating with them. You should be on strike demanding worker rights, more rights for the workers and the proletariat. So there are work stoppages in France. Well, you're not getting those in Germany. Nobody's going on strike at the Messerschmitt plant demanding, you know, more overtime and stopping the production. They're just rolling off the lines, and they're state-of-the-art aircraft. The advantage of work that the Germans have from the Treaty of Versailles being disarmed to almost zero is that they're now starting with a clean slate. They're able to take and look at, oh, we have a clean slate. Well, what is the latest technical advancement in this area, this aircraft engine? What can we do? So what they wind up with is the 109, which is what you get when you can start with a clean slate, you have an open budget, and nobody's going to stop the work once it gets going. You have this doctrinal disconnect. Well, now again, Germany comes away from World War I and goes, we were on the receiving end of something called the tank. And man, those things are powerful. And they're so hard for infantry to deal with. And, you know, when they're there and you have no means to stop them, the infantry panic, they run away, there's nothing you can do. You can't, they're unstoppable, they're wonderful. Well, we need to have those. Well, French, meanwhile, they look at the end of World War I. They've got several thousand of these Renault FT-17s, which are temperamental and by any standards, except maybe 1918, crude as mud. Break down constantly, have to need a lot of maintenance to keep them going. They're slow. They don't move much faster than a walking man because they're not meant to. They look at all these tanks and they're like, well, they're perfectly good, and this is how we won the last war, so this is how we're going to win the next war. But the Germans are like, wait a minute. You know, they're on their own. They're thinking, this thing has potential. And we have more powerful engines, and we have better metallurgy than we ever did before. And so we can make them go faster. We can make them go longer range. Oh, wow. So what if we put infantry into tractors that go with them and can keep up with them? And what if we put our tow artillery with tractors to keep up with them? We create this package. Well, this package is what we call the Panzer Division. This package is fully self-contained. This package becomes the Schwerpunkt, the spear point of the German army. Meanwhile, the French are thinking, business as usual. Well, what's missing here is the Germans then put one more element into it. C-cubed, command control communications. The two-way radio. The French are still relying on telephones because that is how we do it. We use telephones. The soldiers, they lay the telephone lines. If they're smart, they bury them so they're less likely broken by artillery fire, and that's how we do our business. Everything is methodical. Sir?
The Germans had 500 two-way radios per mobile division.
Right.
They're motorized.
Right, down to the last individual tank.
The British had 50 per division. The French had 15.
Yep. I was going to touch on that.
Ooh, that's a big difference there.
It's huge.
Per division.
It's huge. So my point about the doctrinal disconnect, it's about battle tempo. How fast can you operate and for how long can you sustain that pace? The Allies just didn't get the battle tempo shift that the Germans were about to impose on them. When you added increased mobility of the newer, more modern tank and tractor designs or half-track designs, when you put radios in them, as the gentleman just pointed out, you put radios down to the individual tanks, two-way radios, not the commander has a two-way radio and all of his subordinates have a receiver. Everybody can talk to each other in real time. The coordination is unprecedented. Before this, armies relied on verbal communication, relied on telephones when they had them. They had to rely on messengers bringing a written or verbal message. That's huge. Whatever radio communications they had was the old Morse code. Tap, 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 tap. That's what they had. French tanks in 1940, some of their best tanks, they had a two-way radio. It was a tap, Morse code tap, radio telegrapher type. It wasn't voice.
So it was easy to break.
It was easy to break. It was also clumsy as all Dickens to try to use under battlefield conditions. You're in this tank, bouncing around. Your tank's getting hit from every direction. Granted, your armor's so thick, you're safe. But here you are trying to tap out a message as this tank is rumbling around, bouncing, or, you know, they're moving, they're shifting, and you're, you know, I can imagine. Imagine if you're in your car trying to use your, trying to text somebody. And then the road is, it's got a lot of potholes in it. You can see where your message is going to go from, yeah, can you meet me up to blah, 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 blah. You know, and this is essentially what the problem is this battle tempo. The Germans...
And it went to the air forces, too. The French Air Force relied upon telegraph communications to send orders around, even between squadrons.
And again, there you go. There's a problem, is that you have this disconnect. Now, it's not that they don't know about the technology. It's that they don't think it's necessary. The top leadership doesn't believe it's a necessity. They think, no, we want
so it's going backwards.
Well, no. What they're doing is, I'm going to quote General André Beaufait, who, in a post-war interview, he was on the staff, the French army staff of General Gamelin, who was the top French commander in the Battle of France. He said, well, it's a problem. It's not unique to the French. It's that we just won a war, and we thought ourselves too clever. They thought we won. So we did everything right. So as I put up here, Waltz versus the Jitterbug, think of it as a dance competition. 1918, the Allies won because everybody danced the waltz. And they were just that much better at it, and they were able to win the dance competition. Well, 1940 is the rematch. The Allies are going to waltz again. Only grading is on tempo. And the Germans are doing the Jitterbug. And they've practiced. Because not only have they changed their doctrine, they have adopted a new doctrine and have been adopting new technology with great eagerness. They've gained valuable experience. The Anschluss with Austria. Sir?
It seems to me that the Blitzkrieg had a major flaw which the French didn't take advantage of, because they greatly outran their supply line. They could have been cut off.
We'll touch on that. We're going to touch on that a bit.
Especially across Belgium, when they had a 200-mile-long supply line, that could have easily been cut.
We'll touch on that a little later as we're going along here. So the battle tempo issue is this, is that the Germans have figured out that when everybody can talk to each other in real time, it doesn't have to be face-to-face to do it, a commander can exert his control and direction over a broad battlefield, whereas a commander who can't do that, who has to rely on signal flags and messengers, is nowhere near as capable of exerting command and control over the battlefield. The other issue is that basically the French army bit off more than they could chew. And by that, what I mean is, they basically had a plan, a defensive plan, is that as war clouds are gathering, as the war got going, and once war started... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm going to back to this for just a second. As I was saying, the Germans gained valuable experience without fighting before the invasion of France, even before Poland. When Hitler pulled his Anschluss with Austria, he sent the army streaming down there as quickly as possible, because it was all about speed for Hitler. You know, make that grab. Hit them so fast your political enemies don't know what to do. The German army had a motor down to Austria. And during that rush of the German army, so fledgling German army down to Austria, they learned a lot of valuable lessons about keeping motor vehicles on the road and moving in large numbers over a protracted period of time. And they realized where all their shortcomings were. And they realized we need more fuel trucks, we need more repair vehicles, we need a longer logistical tail, and it's got to be a lot thicker. We need recovery vehicles, repair vehicles. We have to make this organic to the motorized formations, not something that's part of Army Corps and then they got to call up the line to get it sent around. No, it has to be right there with the division at the regimental, even the battalion level. So they learned that just from the Anschluss. And then they take Czechoslovakia without firing a shot. Britain and France gives them the Sudetenland, so they won't go to war. So again, German army motors into Czechoslovakia to take control of the Sudetenland. They realize, okay, we've made improvements, we've added things, but we need to do more, we need to add more. Because this was a longer trip, this is a bigger operation, We need just that much more logistical tail. So they did. Because of the economy, because of domestic politics, and because of the defensive mindset, France and Britain do not get this. They do not practice their whatever maneuvers they do and little experiments they manage to pull off here and there with mechanization, with tanks. It's like, you know, three men on a bicycle compared to what the Germans are doing. So you don't really get it. So the French start forming armored divisions, but they have a really stubby little logistical tail like a hamster. It just is not going to do it, and they will find that out the hard way when the fighting starts. So now we come to why they bit off more than they can chew. War breaks out, Germany takes Poland. Belgium is now threatened, Holland is now threatened. They're scared. France has a defensive plan called the Deal Plan, which is to go up to the Deal River, which is up in the north into Belgium, and basically bring Belgium into their defensive line. Well, then Holland starts jumping up and down and going, well, what about us? We're in danger now. They just took Norway and Denmark. They're going to come for us. Don't forget us. So Maurice Gamelin, who's in charge of both the French army and the British expeditionary forces, oh, very well, we'll extend to the Breda line, the so-called Breda variant, the Breda River. We'll help the Dutch too. Well, think about the factors, folks. Smaller army. They've got supply shortages of every kind, equipment shortages of every kind because of all their industrial problems. They're already maxed out just on the French frontier. And now they're going to extend into Belgium. And now they're going to extend into Holland. In order to do this, pardon me?
They become even thinner.
Exactly. In order to do this, they take 9th Army, which was supposed to be their reserve. They put them all the way up in the north. You're going to hold this way out here. You're way out in the left field there. And we're going to thin the line. And so they look at the line. Gamelin and his generals look at the line. They're like, we can thin it at the Ardennes. Tanks can't get through that. They can't get through forests to the Ardennes. It's too rough. Nobody gets through the Ardennes with anything more than infantry, and we can handle it with some reserve divisions. So they plink 10 reserve Category B divisions down there. Remember the Category Bs, the guys that are 40-something. They plop them down there, and they say, this is your line, and you're going to hold it. Oh, by the way, you'll be holding about 3-4 times the area that doctrine calls for because that's just the way it's going. But don't worry, this will be a quiet sector. Well, this is the problem, is that you've got this Allied coalition, you've stretched your army too thin, and you stretched it thin at one point in the center of your line. And you're saying, everything will be fine. What could possibly go wrong? So miss three. France had just done her part, the Allies should have won. Like somehow the French weren't all in. Well, you got the doctrine of battle temple, advantage Germany. Logistics, 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 as I yell at my students. This is what we're talking about. The Germans gained priceless experience with logistics, and Poland really galvanized it for them. Because here they're doing it, and they're shooting for real. So they came away with, they learned some lessons. Offense versus defense, discipline versus initiative, advantage Germany. Okay, Germany is all about offense. Blitzkrieg is an offensive approach. The French, we're going to defend everything. Their attitude is one of defense and methodical battle. Discipline versus initiative. Now, everybody thinks the Germans are the disciplined ones. Well, actually, the French have a long tradition of can be brutally authoritarian discipline when you are in the army. French officers in particular were instilled traditionally with a degree of self-discipline, a degree of discipline that basically said you follow orders and die trying. That's your options. Follow orders or die trying. You break, disobey orders, you not only can be shot, you probably will be shot. They shot a lot of their people in the First World War for breaches of discipline. They were not hesitant. It may be, you know, I'm not sure if that stems from the age of Napoleon. Dana could probably correct me on that. I do know that it's pretty harsh. I do know that was one of their downfalls in the Franco-Prussian War. The officers took no initiative at the unit level because they wouldn't even conceive of violating orders. The First World War, they had incidents at Verdun. One fort commander refused to let the commanding general of the region into the fort because he didn't know who he was and said, well, you're not my commanding officer, so I'm not going to let you in. In fact, I should arrest you as a spy, sir. Get away from my fort door. Germans were all about initiative. This goes back to Clausewitz. This goes back to the Prussian school of warfare. It's all about the individual commanders looking through the fog of war, as it were, as Clausewitz called it, seeing what needed to be done and doing it. What Clausewitz agreed with Antoine-Henri de Jomini, the coup d'oeil, literally the stroke of the eye, or having the eye, to look at what's going on as a commander and know in an instant what to do and then just doing it. That kind of initiative you did not find in the French officer corps as a rule. It was not taught them because it contradicted the idea of discipline. So advantage Germany. Tactical air power. Oh, this is just, the Germans had it hands down. And again, you have this French starting late on the problem. You have them divided domestically. You have them economically at a disadvantage, industrially at a disadvantage, and so on. Doctrinally at a disadvantage. They're still teaching their fighter pilots to dogfight like they're in a biplane in the First World War. The Germans, meanwhile, are using speed as the element of attack.
And they had all that experience in Spain.
Bingo. Yeah. Spain, Poland, Norway. By the time they get to France, they've already done their thing in Spain, Poland, Norway, Denmark.
France did not have an air force.
Not one worth mentioning.
It had a collection of aircraft. It did not have an organization.
Yeah, the irony of that, and I have the numbers in here somewhere, the irony of that is that the pilots, the fighter pilots, were highly trained individuals. They spent, I think, was it 2 years total on training and retraining, constant training, before they considered them fully fit for combat, which was another disadvantage because once you started taking losses, because you had these high training standards, refilling your ranks is a much more protracted process. You're not willing to put, the mindset is you're not willing to put these less trained, in quotes, people out there in harm's way. So you have this rapid degradation of pilots. You know, your pilot pool starts shrinking real quick. So tactical air power, Germany's learned all the lessons of Spain. They've learned all the lessons of others. They've studied them. They now have a system. And they also have something called a dive bomber, an American invention they adopted enthusiastically. Because they realized, wow, this thing...
They bought a couple aircraft
Curtis Hawks. Yeah, Ernst Udet bought Curtis Hawk biplanes because he saw them demonstrated as dive bombers. He's like, ooh, that is cool. So he brought them back and he demonstrates them and they're like, we need one of our own. And so they came up with the Stuka. And the Stuka is easy prey for a fighter without escort, but man, if there's nothing to oppose it,
It's a
lethal dive bomber. It's an accurate dive bomber, and the pilot, the crews were well trained, well practiced in dive bombing. So, and the way they used the Stukas in interdiction, but they also went one step further. They wouldn't just send them out into areas where the army's operating and tell them go look for something to break. They said, "Oh, by the way, all these neat new armored vehicles, we have this new armored car and it's got radios in it and extra radio gear, and not only does the guy in it get to talk to the other armored vehicles of the Panzer formation,
but
he gets the other big radio set we crammed in there, he talks to you, Hans, up in your Stuka, and he tells you where the ground guys want you to put your bombs, and he's riding right up there front with them. And don't worry, Hans, he's not some army stiff telling you what to do, he's one of ours, he's a Luftwaffe officer. Forward air controller. That's your first really, truly dedicated forward air controllers. This is how ahead of the curve the Germans are on this, in grasping what combined arms really is. So, hands down, just numbers and quality, Germany has a huge advantage. The French are trying to make up for it. Now, mind you, they were buying aircraft from the United States. They got some pretty good ones from us, and so on, but when you came right down to it, they didn't really have it together. I'm trying to spot my notes here on the numbers of aircraft. I could swear I put them in here. I'll probably find it later, folks, after the talk is over. That's usually how it goes. essentially, if my memory serves correct, the French were able to put about 800 fighter airplanes up there, modern. This is a hodgepodge collection. It's mostly those Morans I showed you, which were really an easy prey for the 109s, plus a mixed bag of Bloch 152s, which had a nice armament, a pair of 20mm cannons and four machine guns in the wings. But performance-wise, forget it. It could just about catch a German bomber, and that was about it. It was no match for the 109. They had the Dewoitine 520, which could stand up to the 109. It wasn't as fast, but it was more maneuverable, and it was fast enough that it wasn't at a severe disadvantage to the 109. So in a stand-up fight, the D520s could give them a good hard time. And with a good pilot behind it, they could knock down, they could give as good as they got. And in fact, they did. But unfortunately, the D520 is just coming online. You have all the work stoppage problems, even sabotage within the French plants by communists who, acting on orders from Moscow, are trying to back up the non-aggression treaty. And so they're trying to hinder the French war effort against their friend, the Germans. So they're trying desperately to do this. Bombers, the French had about 100 obsolete relics of a bygone era. They had modern types, but they maybe had... Oh, we just had three of the new Breguet 693s delivered.
They had a squadron of Dauntlesses.
Not Dauntlesses, Vindicators.
Oh, Vindicators.
Yeah, American-made Vindicators. They belonged to the French Navy, by the way. They were with the Air Naval. So they were French Navy. So they weren't immediately involved in the combat.
But they did better than the Air Force.
Well, here's what happened. The French were buying American airplanes. Now, first of all, we got shortfalls and everything, but critically, we're short in fighters. So, what do we put? We need a fighter airplane. We go to the Americans. What do they have to offer us? The Curtiss factory offers us the Hawk 75, which is the French, which is an export version of the P-36. It's a radial engine fighter airplane, modern airplane, decent, good maneuverability, just great handling. Not nowhere near as fast as a 109, but faster than the damn Maury. So the French are like, look, we'll take everyone you can sell us. Well, of course, America's neutral. And there's a lot of anti-war sentiment in America, especially after World War I. A lot of Americans felt we were suckered into going to war, and they don't want to get involved in another European entanglement. So there's a lot of pressure politically not to sell weapons to anybody, especially anybody in Europe. The French still managed to wrangle a supply of Hawk 75s. They acquitted themselves very well, all things being equal, but that would be a whole other story. I mean, we could do a whole other talk, Dana, on the French, the Air Corps component of this campaign. So tactical air power has managed Germany. The Schwerpunkt, I mentioned, the spear point, that's the whole package to me of the German Blitzkrieg, the mechanized form of warfare of combined arms, of the tanks at the front. They're followed by infantry and armored half-tracks. They're followed by artillery being pulled by tractors. They have the integrated anti-aircraft weapons, anti-tank guns in the Panzer Division. It's a fully self-contained unit with its own logistical tail. It has its own mobile workshops to recover tanks on the battlefield and repair them and put them back on the line. It is absolutely, in terms of the rest of the world, unprecedented. And it's all tied together by two-way radios, two-way voice radio net. Coalition of the Unwilling. In this corner, Nazi Germany, spoiling for a fight. In that corner, we have France, we have Great Britain, it's BEF, which is basically a shadow of the BEF that went to Europe in 1914. We have Belgium, we have Holland. Okay? And Holland doesn't want to fight, Belgium doesn't want to fight. The French are divided, and the British are only fighting because they want to protect Belgium's neutrality once again. Oh dear. So that means four different command structures, four different agendas, four different
organizations,
four different supply chains, four different ways of, you know, and intentions. I mean, on paper, and again, this is the whole thing. On paper, the Allies outnumber the Germans. But when you start drill down into the qualitative elements and the doctrine, the whole thing falls apart like it did. Holland, the Dutch call their experience in World War II, the German invasion, the 5 days battle. They held on for 5 days. The Belgians, I think, lasted about 2 weeks, and after that point, they were really not a viable in any sense except just adding to the flow of soldiers and civilian refugees flowing to the coast trying to get out of the way of the German army. It just simply isn't the case. France, it's not that France didn't do her part, it's just that France, even if she had thrown all in, there were so many different things wrong at so many different levels, so many things deficient from doctrine to material to industrial capacity to economic capacity. She really wasn't in a position to get in this fight and with any hope of winning. She was just overmatched. So, going forward, here's a map of France. So remember I've mentioned the Breda variant. So basically they're talking about originally, oh, we're just going to cover about that much of our frontier. But that's going to be a problem because now the Belgians are in here, so now we're going to extend up this way into Belgium. And now the Dutch are yelling, help, help. So we're going all the way up here. So the line's getting thinner. And it's getting thinner, it's getting thinner. Let's see if I can read it on this fuzzy. Yeah. Basically, right in here, you've got the Ardennes region. And right in here is where, along the Meuse River, is where they plopped the, there's Sedan. Is that Sedan? No, that's not it. There's Metz. Anyway, right along here.
Sorry, I almost went out of the
end. You killed it. It's, aha, a fifth columnist.
Oh, there we go. I see it.
The fifth columnist. No worries. So hopefully.
I know.
No, be mindful.
What time do we have, by the way?
2:47. You only have
13
minutes.
13 minutes. Do you want to just go to questions?
We can go to questions. Why not? No, don't. It's fine. I'm thinking I'm in a classroom with a captive audience, so you'll have to all forgive me.
Okay.
You have a question, sir?
Well, I was going to ask if you could speak to your remaining 2 myths real briefly.
Sure. So one is the big one is the French are cowards. That's myth number 4. And basically the idea of cowardice is absurd. And the reason I say it's absurd is this. Hey, we're alive. Let's jump right to it.
We'll jump right to it.
Okay. The 55th Division, which is a Category B reserve division at Sedan, they are right at the point of German attack. The Germans come through the Ardennes, managed to pull a huge strategic deception on the Allies. They convince the Allies that the main effort is up in Belgium. In fact, it's through the Ardennes. And yes, Virginia tanks can go through the woods. The 55th Division is at Sedan, and they're basically set up to fail from the get-go. They're 40-something reservists. Their shortages of equipment, basically their training is substandard. Their shortages, they're stretched too thin, because remember how I explained how they stretch the line. They stretch them way too thin. The reservists have no anti-tank guns in the division and no anti-aircraft weapons. And they are hit by tanks, and they are hit by Stukas, and they are hit repeatedly and hard, straight out of the gate. The Germans can force their way across the river. The 55th starts panicking because they are facing tanks and they have no way to deal with them. And so this is where we have the famous collapse of the 55th Division at Sedan, the so-called tank panic, where they supposedly saw some of their own tanks, and then the rumors started flying, the Germans were in our rear, and the division essentially collapsed. Has anybody ever seen the movie Viva Max? It's an old movie. Ah, you've seen it. So, when the wrong flare is fired up and the National Guardsmen retreat and they literally just melt away. Well, the 55th was always postulating was set up to fail. Their performance is not echoed by other divisions, including reserve divisions. They fight as best they can. They are unable to match the battle tempo that the Germans are setting. The Blitzkrieg attack is designed to decapitate the opposing army. It's designed to punch through the line, spread out in the rear, and destroy command control infrastructure, destroy command posts, decapitate the opposing army. And that's exactly what they do. The French still try to fight back. They organize counterattacks. They have two light tank battalions at Sedan. They are outgunned, they are outnumbered, they are outclassed, they are unsupported, and yet to the last tank they fought. In fact, they went, the 7th Battalion went head-on with about four times the number of Panzers. They had short little 37mm guns. The FCM-36 is what they're running. Let me jump ahead to this. Maybe quickly. This is what they did have. They had machine guns. This is what they probably looked like the day that the attack began. That guy with the automatic rifle, he has, if he's in the 55th, he has two magazines total. That's it. If they had anything resembling an anti-tank gun, it's this World War I piece, which could just about penetrate a light armored car. This is the tank they had, the FCM-36. The French built 100 of them. This is one of the few surviving examples in the world. It actually runs. It's at the French Cavalry School at Saumur. It has a stubby little 37mm gun and machine gun. It's two men crammed in there. The armor is well sloped and 40mm thick. So the German guns are 37mm weapons as well. They couldn't get through the armor. But the French gun couldn't get through the German armor, even though it was all that much thinner, because that stupid little gun is just left over from World War I, and it has not improved much. So the French fought head-on with these guys to the last tank running. Literally, the tanks were being penetrated. When they were, they keep fighting. And they just keep fighting. The History Channel ran a series of greatest tank battles, but they actually found a veteran of the 4th Battalion, they also operated these. He said, we didn't have time to think, but we couldn't get through their armor. This man was watching his friends dying all around, and he saw French tanks on fire being penetrated, but he kept on fighting. He said, we tried to avenge them. Our short cannon could not pierce their armor, so we sought to blind the enemy drivers. We didn't even think if we can make it or not. We do what we can. 29 tanks went in from the 4th Battalion. 19 were knocked out in that fight. They managed to stop the German advance. This particular veteran, he was knocked out when a shell hit the commander's cupola, which is the top portion of the turret. It broke the periscope loose, and the periscope fell on his head and basically crowned him, knocked him cold. And so his driver, realizing he was out of action, took him out of there, and they got to safety. One FCM commander, when the tank was penetrated and the driver wounded and the tank caught fire, he kicked his driver out, went back into the tank, and kept fighting until he fired off every last shell. Oh, and they only had 12 armor-piercing rounds. That's all they ever issued. So he was just plinking away that's the weapon system there. You can see how small it is. You move it, aim it, and you moved it and aimed it. There's a coaxial machine gun. You move that thing and aimed it with your hip. He had a brace. You see the padding on his lower back. It's straight out of World War I. And he had to do everything. French tanks had a one-man turret. This is what the reservists were facing at Sedan. Great picture. This is Rommel 7th getting ready to cross the Meuse. Tanks to the front, half tracks and support, echelon artillery behind. Everything coordinated by radios. Stukas above, fighters above. The French didn't even know it was coming because in the run-up, they couldn't even get a recon airplane in there. Everyone that went in, even with heavy fire escort, was cut to pieces by the Luftwaffe. We were swarming over the whole front. So here we have the German advance. They start up in the north in Belgium. They get the BEF and the French First Army occupied. They're in Holland. They got the whole north going. And then, a couple days later, here comes the hammer right through the Ardennes, right into the face of the 55th Reserve. Every machine gunner, two magazines. That's it. They still try to fight. That's the thing. Imagine yourself, I have a rifle, I have a bayonet, so do my friends. Our squad, he's got two magazines. There's tanks. More tanks than I ever saw in my life, even in a newsreel. And they're coming right for us. Is it cowardice? They haven't even trained you. They haven't given you anything to deal with it. You have to ask yourself, what would you do? Would you do like the Japanese, charge them? For what purpose? I think most soldiers who would otherwise be considered brave would either get out of their way or give up to stay alive and hope that maybe something better will happen. Maybe the war will end soon and I'll go home.
You have 5 minutes.
Thank you. That is the big beast of the French campaign, the Charbon Abyss. Another example of French cowardice. I'll jump up ahead of this. This thing has all kinds of ergonomic issues. That's what happens when you fire on it with a standard German anti-tank gun at its thinnest armor at the back. These are all non-penetrating. You can't get through. The Germans, you hit the track, they hit the track on the right there. Didn't even break the track. The Germans call this the Colossa. Meet Capitaine Pierre Bellot and his crew of the Uray. I believe this is the World War II's first tank ace. Not a German, a Frenchman. His battalion goes under the attack at Staun, trying to stem the breakthrough at Sedan. The Germans are pouring across the Meuse. They're fighting for the crucial crossroad town of Staun. Over here, we have Bülow's battalion. Bülow's tank is over there. He, because of terrain, he gets cut off. He gets separated from the main advance. He winds up going into the town, whereas the rest of the battalion swept around the town. He comes head-to-head with 13 German panzers, a pair of Panzer IVs, 11 Panzer IIIs. They're stopped in the town because the town has been changing hands. It's already changed hands over a dozen times. In 2 days, this town will change hands 17 times. 17 times in 2 days. I thought they were cowardly. Oh, and by the way, they're all reservists, and they're facing Regiment Grossdeutschland, if I remember correctly, 10th Panzer. Grossdeutschland is an elite motorized unit. Bülow takes one look at him. He tells his driver, who fires the bow gun in the Charbie with a foot trip, notice the bow gun. Driver, Sergeant Durupt, get the leader. Durupt gets the leader. Bülow turns his turret gun, because Bülow's in the turret, he has to do everything. French tanks had one-man turret, one of their problems. So the guy in the turret is everything. He's the loader, the gunner, the commander, the bottle washer, he does it all. That's a power-driven turret, it's not hand-cranked. German panzers are hand-cranked. He goes for the tail end, Charlie, brews him up. Well, the Germans aren't just sitting there taking it, but they're too close together. Now they can't move because they've just capped both ends of the column. They fire back with everything they've got. Well, one by one, Durupt and Bülow destroy each German tank. There was a clutch of light tanks down at the back end of the column. They try to run for it. Bülow keeps going. He manages to peg some of those, chases the rest off. They make a run around looking for trouble to cause. They encounter a pair of anti-tank guns, 37mm Pak 36 standard German anti-tank gun. They destroy both of them. When they return to French lines, they get out of their tank. And they start counting all the shot gouges and dents. They've been hit nonstop while they ran through the town. They were shooting at anything German they could catch. The Uray was hit 140 times by German armor-piercing shells. No penetrations. Crew were fine. Maybe a little deaf. But that was a testimony to that tank. And that was one tank tackling almost an entire company, head on. They didn't hesitate. They didn't try to retreat. They didn't go, oh my goodness, it's a whole bunch of panzers and we're one tank. He pitched right in on them. A day later, the town of Landrecies, two Sharps, two of the same type, go into the town of Landrecies. They find themselves confronting an entire reconnaissance battalion for a panzer division. Instead of retreating, they went on a rampage. The low ball count is 50 German half-tracks, light tanks, and armored cars knocked out or destroyed. The high count is almost over 100. There was so much smoke and shooting going on, the French crews weren't sure exactly, but they said at least 50. And the Germans clearly were rattled. And that was just two tanks. But anyway, so much more. As you can see, the myths just don't stand up. So I can go on all day with examples like this. It wasn't a cakewalk. It wasn't cowardice. It was basically a country that had not the economic means, the population, the industrial base, the means to put up a fight single-handed or carry the load the way they had in 1914. And they paid for it. So thank you all. Thank you all so much.